Mark Twain famously described his coldest winter as the summer he spent in San Francisco. One reason for the chill is the fog. It rolls in off the cold waters of the northeastern Pacific and regularly blankets Northern California. It makes for pretty pictures and slow traffic, and it does something else that's largely unnoticed. It waters the big redwood trees along the coast. Now, NPR's Christopher Joyce reports scientists suspect the fog may be disappearing.
Biologist James Johnstone grew up in Virginia, but when he moved to the University of California at Berkeley, he discovered what really weird weather could be.
It can be 55 degrees and humid along the coast. If you go up a mountain slope or you go inland, just say a few miles, you can go to 80, 90 degrees and 20% humidity.
This soggy to toasty divide, scientists call it a gradient, is part of what causes California's coastal fog. The other part is what's going on in the ocean.
There's a systematic connection between fog and a variety of other ocean and atmosphere factors that seem to be ultimately driven by the position of the high-pressure cell that resides off the coast of California in summer.
That atmospheric cell, along with cold ocean upwelling and the land gradient, all conspire to make fog. And after looking at historical climate data for the region, Johnstone found that the fog is diminishing.
We look at the evolution of that land temperature pattern. It strongly suggests that there's been maybe a 30% decline in fog frequency.
That can amount to 3 hours less fog a day. Now, a lot of that decline happened before the late 1990s. The all-time low was 1997. Since then, the fog frequency has returned almost to what it was in the 1950s, when direct observations of fog began. Over the century, though, records suggest the long-term trend is a fog decline, and Johnstone doesn't know why. And that worries people who care about California's redwood trees.
These forests take up to maybe 30-40% of their water requirements a year from fog here in what is essentially a Mediterranean climate.
That's Ruskin Hartley. He runs a 90-year-old organization called Save the Redwoods, which helped fund the fog research.
The fog that's caught sustains a rich web of life, everything from the 300-foot-high trees to the salamanders to the ferns and the understory that really wouldn't be there if it wasn't for the influence of fog. So what happens to the fog is critical to the future of these forests.
Johnstone's research appears in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Most scientists predict changes in temperature, rainfall, and even ocean currents as the planet's climate warms. Johnstone says what ultimately happens to California's fog machine will depend a lot on how global climate change affects California. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Here in California, the construction industry will soon have to meet new environmentally friendly building standards. But a law that takes effect next year faces criticism from some places you might not expect. From Santa Monica, Ethan Lindsay reports.
Dr. Paul Song walks around a half-built modern home he and his wife are constructing for more than $1 million. The house is just blocks from the beach in a very posh Santa Monica neighborhood.
Well, I think the first thing you see is the wood is all blue.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is,
Song
is
points out what will be the home's green features, things like the non-toxic blue wood, a urinal that uses 100% recycled water, and a floor heating system.
All the floors are concrete, but in it, it's radiant heat that's going to be powered by solar. Basically, this floor will always be nice and warm for my wife who has cold feet.
When the house is finished, it will be the first 100% energy-independent home in the city. The home meets and even goes beyond the eco-building standards set by the city and the state. And it will be certified as platinum under the U.S. Green Building Council's residential LEED, or LEED, rating system. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's the industry standard and essentially a green point system. Sean King is the general contractor.
So you get a certain amount of points. There's categories, there's energy. So each category has a certain amount of points, and we have to achieve, I believe it's 100 points
to get platinum.
Yeah.
The state law requires all government buildings achieve at least 50 points, certified LEED silver. But preservationists say this point system and the whole new push towards green is leaving historic buildings out of the equation. Specifically, the National Historic Trust says LEED points overvalue new construction. Linda Dishman is the executive director of the Los Angeles Conservancy. She says preserving an old building should get more points than it does.
If you save a historic building, you can get up to 3 points. If you use recycled carpet, you get 1 point. Is saving a whole building really the same as recycled carpet?
Historic advocates are working with LEED to up their points and also promote other building standards that weigh historic preservation more heavily. Dishman says, ironically, old buildings are actually greener than new ones because of embodied energy.
Embodied energy is how much energy it takes to build a building. So you have a craftsman home in a lovely historic neighborhood. You have the redwood that was trucked and shipped in. And then if you tear that all down, all of that historic fabric gets shipped off to the dump.
In fact, Dishman claims some studies show that it can take 35 years or more for a new energy-efficient building to recover the carbon used to build it. And yet that fact doesn't mean much, because new buildings are just more fun for architects to design and are just plain cheaper for developers to build.
I think everybody would agree that historic preservation is important in and of its own right.
Santa Monica's green building advisor is Brendan McEnany. He says problem is historic preservation can just be too difficult and too costly.
You can't just sell people on a green level. This kind of has to make financial sense as well. And to the market at large that maybe isn't thinking first and foremost on a green perspective, that's where you have to be directing your efforts at.
Back at his home site, Paul Song says, yes, this home will be brand new, but he did his best to preserve some of that embodied energy.
What people won't realize when they drive by the house is that we did the first 100% recycled demolition. We tore this house down nail by nail, brick by brick.
Those nails and bricks were then shipped to build other homes in Mexico. And some of the old wood torn down from the previous house will be used as floorboards in the new one. In this case, it's a compromise for both sides. It's just not on a budget that all homeowners can afford. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Lindsay in Santa Monica.
The Environmental Protection Agency has kicked a proverbial fire ant mound in Texas. This week, the state sued the EPA over carbon dioxide emissions. The agency regards CO2 as a pollutant, one that needs to be reduced. But the governor says that's a jobs killer for industry, especially the state's huge petrochemical plants. As NPR's John Burnett reports, the EPA is standing firm with the help of a native Texan.
There's an environmental love fest going on at a Mexican restaurant in downtown Austin.
We'd like to welcome you to a celebration of the appointment of Al Armendariz as the regional administrator for Region 6 of the Environmental Protection Agency.
The lanky 39-year-old environmental engineer, a native of El Paso, stands awkwardly at the mic in front of the adoring crowd.
Thank you. That was a great introduction.
The environmental activists here consider Armendariz one of their own. As an associate professor at Southern Methodist University in Dallas for the past 8 years, he became a familiar figure at the Capitol, testifying against air polluters. Texas environmentalists had been petitioning and suing state authorities for years to enforce the Clean Air Act and rein in the state's mammoth coal-fired power plants, refineries, and chemical facilities. Now they may get their way. The Dallas EPA office is responsible for 5 states and 66 Indian tribes. But Armendariz says since he began in November, air quality in Texas has occupied half of his time because there's so much that needs fixing.
There's no doubt in my mind or at any of the leadership at EPA that the way the air programs have been run in the state of Texas for the last 15 years is going to end, and it's going to end really soon.
Talk like that has raised hackles in a state where business is king and the unofficial motto is don't mess with Texas. Steve Minnick is with the Texas Association of Business.
We are approaching what many of my members would represent to be regulation for the sake of regulation.
Last year, the EPA declared carbon dioxide a dangerous greenhouse gas and a threat to public health. With Texas such a major contributor of CO2, the EPA's declaration is seen by some as nothing less than an attack on the Texas way of life. On Tuesday, Governor Rick Perry announced a federal lawsuit challenging that CO2 decision.
When the EPA recently declared carbon dioxide a toxic substance, they put countless businesses, farms, even large churches in their crosshairs.
Perry is also steamed over the EPA's intrusion into Texas air standards. Al Armendariz has told the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality that its program for granting air emissions permits to industrial facilities violates the Federal Clean Air Act, and if they don't tighten it up and allow more public input, the EPA could conceivably take it over.
It's not broken, it's just misunderstood.
Brian Shaw is chairman of the State Environmental Agency.
Our program has been very effective at attaining environmental improvements far faster than a lot of other states, but done so in a way that meets up to the intent of the Clean Air Act.
He points out that Texas has in recent years had measurable reductions in nitrous oxide emissions, carbon dioxide, and ozone levels without more regulation from Washington. Undeterred, the EPA's Armendariz says Texas needs to do more to protect its air.
We're glad to see that in many areas of Texas, air quality is improving, but there are still many communities in Texas where there are levels of air pollutants that are too high.
One of them is the Houston area, home to a vast petrochemical complex. 2 years ago, the Sierra Club and Environment Texas, acting on behalf of citizens, sued Shell Oil for emissions at its Deer Park refinery far in excess of its permitted limits. The lawsuit claimed unauthorized, accidental emissions occurred on average more than once a week for 5 years. Texas Sierra Club Director Ken Kramer, among others, blames state regulators for letting refineries get away with these sorts of violations with a slap on the wrist.
Because they say, oh, well, those were really accidental emissions, since it's not part of our routine emissions. It was because we had, you know, a problem with this particular unit. But it happens over and over and over again.
A federal judge agreed with the citizens groups, and Shell said it would reduce its accidental emissions by 80%. In its defense, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality says it reviews all unauthorized emissions and takes punitive action when industries break the rules. But the Houston Chronicle wondered in an editorial why two environmental groups had to go to court to do the job state regulators are supposed to be doing. If the EPA has its way, that state of affairs will end. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Many, many people outside the Washington, New York area, including many of our listeners, became fed up with all the media coverage of those recent blizzards. You know what I'm talking about.
Good morning, snow monster.
Washington, D.C. is getting hammered so bad that officials are pulling plows off the road.
The nation's capital gave new meaning to the term White House.
Well, the thing about the snowfall here in Washington is that it wasn't only historic, it could actually have real-world consequences, nationally and even internationally. We begin the hour with a look at whether climate legislation is doomed, at least this year, and in a few minutes, a cognitive linguist on framing the climate debate. But first to those storms. They happened to affect cities where both politicians and influential media personalities live, people who make law and people who shape public opinion. And the blizzards provided a pretty convenient backdrop for some of those people.
The snow is hammering Washington, D.C. again. I believe God is just saying, I got your global warming here, eh? You want a piece of global warming?
Rumor has it that another storm could be heading this way next week. Global warming, where are you? We want you back.
Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck on the recent storms here. Senator James Inhofe helped his grandkids build an igloo on Capitol Hill. They put up a sign. It read, Al Gore's New Home. His colleague, South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint, posted the following on his Twitter feed. It's going to keep snowing in D.C., he tweeted, until Al Gore cries uncle. On Friday, at a town hall meeting in Nevada, President Obama weighed in as well.
A lot of the people who are opponents of climate change, they say, see, look at that. There's all this snow on the ground. You know, this doesn't mean anything. I want to just be clear that the science of climate change doesn't mean that every place is getting warmer. It means the planet as a whole is getting warmer.
Virtually all climate scientists point out that heavy snow requires warmer weather. And the recent storms are consistent, they say, with climate change. Here's an excerpt from a story by NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce.
Warmer water means more water vapor rises up into the air, and what goes up must come down.
Now, despite a scientific consensus and mountains of data that confirms climate change, the combination of a weak economy, an election year, and that snowstorm may actually torpedo any chance for passing a climate bill this year. Last summer, the House passed a bill written by Democrats Henry Waxman and Ed Markey. That bill will, over time, dramatically reduce America's carbon emissions. But now that Democrats can no longer count on a 60-vote majority in the Senate, Waxman-Markey stands little chance of becoming law. And yet Henry Waxman is still optimistic.
I do believe we can pass a bill this year, a comprehensive bill. And I don't think I'm being Pollyanna about it. People told me I couldn't get a bill out of my committee on energy and climate change. And then they said, well, you got out of your committee, but you'll never get it past the House, and we got it past the House. Now people are saying, well, because the Republicans are being so partisan, you'll never get it through the Senate. But I think we're going to have to get a bipartisan bill in the Senate, and I think we're on track to do that.
Without a congressional bill that addresses the climate crisis, the pledge made by President Obama at the recent UN-sponsored climate conference, a pledge to cut America's CO2 emissions by 17%, well, that pledge would become an empty one. And so two senators, Republican Susan Collins of Maine and Democrat Maria Cantwell of Washington State, are proposing something different, a climate bill that's being framed as a jobs bill. Here's Senator Cantwell.
Really, it's trying to take advantage of the opportunity to get off of carbon and onto alternative sources of energy that will unleash job creation in America and, in the end, take better care of our environment.
And describe how it would work. I mean, would there be a cap-and-trade kind of system where there's a cap on carbon emissions and companies who want to go beyond
that? We think it should be simple. We think we should take the top 2,000 producers who are putting carbon into the atmosphere and instead ask them to start reductions of carbon by the President and Congress setting a reduction level over a gradual period of time, and that anybody who during that time period wants to continue to produce has to participate in an auction and get a permit. The revenue from that would go back to ratepayers, basically to individuals in our economy, to help keep them whole during this time period. So really what they would be getting is an energy rebate. And we think that helps protect consumers, so we don't want to disrupt the U.S. economy. We want to grow the U.S. economy and do so in a predictable way. And that's the kind of thing that businesses can take to the bank. That's the kind of thing that the American consumer believes will help them make a transition.
So let me see if I understand this correctly. If a company that does produce CO2 emissions wants to exceed the limit, they'd have to buy credits, and that money, that revenue, would go back to taxpayers either in the form of a tax credit or something else, and they can then use that to pay their energy costs. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
But why would businesses support a bill like this if, in effect, it means they're going to have to pay for carbon emissions, which are free now? I mean, they can pollute for free.
Because they also know that you have to make the transition. Business looks for predictability. They look for certainty. And if you can set up a system where there is a gradual decrease, a goal that can be met without huge economic disruption, those companies will do that.
Now, why do you think that your idea has a better chance of passing than, say, the Waxman-Markey bill that was passed in the House?
Well, this isn't about which bill or what process. It's about making this simple and clear and predictable. This is the first time we've had a Republican, Susan Collins from Maine, put her name on a piece of legislation and actually push to have it through Congress. And I'm hoping that we'll get other Republican support for that. She knows, and other of my colleagues knows, that if you have something that's predictable, that business can buy into, that people will start migrating off of these fossil fuel-oriented energy solutions and onto green energy solutions, and you could unleash a transition to millions of new jobs.
That's Senator Maria Cantwell. She's a Democrat from Washington State. Senator Cantwell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, Professor George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist at UC Berkeley. He's not a climate scientist, but he's written widely about the problem, as he sees it, in the way the whole climate issue is framed. And it starts, he says, with the term global warming.
I think it has been very problematic. Global warming applies to climate, not weather. And most people don't think of the difference. And so you shouldn't be talking just about global warming. You should be talking about the climate crisis. That, I think, is very important. And to then you explain what a crisis is. But the people who are in the environmental movement are very bad at communication, and they haven't done that.
But, I mean, it seems as if those facts are available. They're out there. They're being discussed all over the place. The facts are clear. Most scientists do not see what they do as a political calling, but a form of research that's rooted in facts. Yet polls show, George Lakoff, that about 57% of the American public believes that global warming is taking place now. That is down 14 points from October of 2008.
There are two reasons for this, the cognitive problems and then the communications problems. The cognitive problems with snow are these. People have, on the whole, a false folk theory about how snow works. They assume that if since snow is cold, it can't come from anything warm. But that's scientifically false, and they haven't heard that over and over and over. So they still believe snow can't come from anything warm. The second thing they believe when they hear global warming is that it applies to every place uniformly on the Earth. That is false, too. They're thinking about weather, not about climate.
Surely some of the problem lies with the scientists themselves. I mean, we heard last year about some climate scientists who were trying to muzzle dissent. I mean, that certainly fueled suspicion that climate change or global warming is a hoax.
Look, that was at a minor place, and you get some people who make mistakes.
No, I mean, we interviewed one of the scientists. I understand that. But the message behind that had an enormous impact.
That's right. And the reason – that's right. And it's very important for the scientists to know that they don't know anything about communication. They're very bad at it. See, the scientists who study weather don't study cognition. They're not cognitive scientists. They're climate scientists. That's understandable. But they don't know that they can't communicate. And they don't know they need to get some people who know something about it.
In a strange way, George Lakoff, we are actually framing the debate because we're talking about climate change. We're not talking about global warming, right? I mean, could we be accused of doing this?
Accused is interesting. The idea of climate change actually was introduced by conservatives, by Frank Luntz, in the 2004 campaign. He found that global warming alarmed people, whereas climate change sounded fine. It was just change, as if it just happened and people weren't responsible. Hmm. And climate is a nice word. It sort of gives an image of palm trees and nice climate as opposed to hurricanes and, you know, and huge snowstorms and floods.
So climate change, in your view, as somebody who I have to presume does not agree with Frank Luntz, is not the best way to talk about this.
Yeah, I think the climate crisis is a much better way to talk about it. You want to say this is a crisis. This is a crisis for civilization. It's a crisis for life on Earth.
That's George Lakoff. He's a cognitive linguist and professor of linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. George Lakoff, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. The world's top climate science institution has conceded that it published errors in its reports. That follows a separate controversy over hacked emails from prominent climate scientists that cast doubt on their objectivity. Most scientists say the evidence for a warming world is still as strong as ever, but as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, some now acknowledge they may need to do some house cleaning and improve their public relations skills.
Scientists don't like to make mistakes, so it was with much embarrassment that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change admitted that it published a real laugher in its latest report on climate science. The IPCC quoted a study that said Himalayan glaciers could completely melt by 2035. Two numbers were transposed. It should have said by the year 2350. As climate skeptics pounced on the mistake, other errors in the IPCC report surfaced. Climate scientists insist that these are minor and that climate change is still a fact. So did the top climate negotiator at the State Department, Todd Stern.
What should not happen is that any individual mistakes, typos, whatever they might be, taken to undermine the very fundamental record from scientists all over the world that this is a serious and growing problem.
But Robert Watson, who ran the IPCC for 6 years, worries that public confidence in climate science has been shaken.
Only 4 or 5 sentences in 3,000 pages is a very small number of mistakes. However, I think given the importance of IPCC, given the importance of the climate change issue, one almost has to find a way now not to allow any mistakes to be propagated.
Watson says that means running every bit of research the IPCC collects, that's thousands of studies from around the world, through even more reviews. Now, reports by the IPCC already go through 2 rounds of outside review. Stephen Hamburg is an ecologist with the Environmental Defense Fund who has worked within IPCC. He says mistakes are just part of doing science.
We have to be careful that we don't hold the consensus on climate change that the IPCC represents to a significantly higher standard than we hold all of science that we herald as the basis of modern society.
But most new science goes through journals before the public sees it. The journals have a way to correct mistakes quickly.
Every journal has a place in the back for corrections. Note when you make a mistake, you correct it. If it's not of significance affecting the fundamental conclusions, we move on.
The IPCC does not have a place for public corrections. Its reports come out every 6 years or so, too slow for corrections, as well as new research. Watson and Hamburg say the organization could fix that by publishing corrections and updates on its website. But then there's the politicking. The United Nations set up the IPCC, and member nations must sign off on every word in the reports. Former IPCC head Robert Watson recalls one nightmarish attempt to get bureaucrats to agree on a shorter, more public-friendly version of one report.
Oh, I mean, after a day of argument, they gave up on the idea because some countries took out 10 sentences or 20 sentences, and someone said, no, I wouldn't have any of those sentences. I'd pick the following 20 sentences.
That's the kind of squabbling that derailed the big UN climate conference in Copenhagen last December. Those deliberations failed, and now the UN's top climate diplomat, Ivo de Boer, is resigning. Some climate scientists say all of this has put them on the defensive. EDF Stephen Hamburg says it also shows that they need to communicate a lot better about how climate scientists reach their conclusions.
We've done a poor job of explaining how these things are done. So how do we make predictions about the future? How do we understand impacts? How much of it's empirical, so it's direct measurement? How much of it is modeled? How much of it's theoretical?
And what it does and doesn't mean when scientists make mistakes. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Tomorrow we'll hear about research that suggests, right or wrong, more facts may not be enough to convince people about the validity of climate science.